Okay, I'd like to welcome you, you faithful few, you remnant, to the Michiana Adventist Forum meeting. Dr. Grellman will begin with prayer, so let's bow our heads.
Dear Father in heaven, thank you for all the blessings you give us. Thank you for the Sabbath day. Thank you for the time that we have to worship, to praise, and this afternoon also to think and learn. Bless Dave Thomas as he makes his presentation, and invite you to be a presence here too.
Dr. Robertson is away for the weekend, our president of Michiana Adventist Forum. Let me remind you, there are envelopes at the back. Those of you who are not procrastinating in planning your financial end-of-year arrangements and would like to include the forum in a small contribution, we would appreciate it. You can take an envelope that's back there for that purpose. Our next meeting is in November, November 14. Dr. Ron Osborne, who is currently doing a postdoctoral fellowship at Wellesley College, will be here. We'll have a kind of a panel discussion with him about his book entitled Death Before the Fall, Biblical Literalism and the Problem of Animal Suffering. So put November 14 on your calendar for Ron Osborne. We welcome Dr. Dave Thomas as our speaker this afternoon. He was born and raised in Africa of missionary parents. You have to go back to at least his grandfather before you get a Thomas who was born in England. So there's a long line of British Adventist missionary folk in Africa. He came to the United States for college, graduated from Atlantic Union College 1975. I know that because I graduated in the same class. He received a Master's of Divinity from Andrews University and was awarded a Doctor of Ministry from Andrews. He has pastored churches in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Washington State. He married Laura Lee Minty. I know that because I was there standing not too far away. He knows I got married because he was there standing not too far away. That means he and I have had a long relationship for these many years. We've sailed together. We have done a lot of construction together. There are actually buildings in Massachusetts and Michigan who are still standing, these many years later. Amazing. Currently, he serves as Dean of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. He and his wife, Laura Lee, have two grown sons. We welcome Dr. Thomas this afternoon.
Well, thank you for gathering. It is indeed true. Gary and I go way back when my family came as immigrants to the East Coast. We ended up in the great industrial city of Worcester, Massachusetts, and who should be there as a member of the church but the Gray family. So from college days until now, we have had a happy association, and I appreciate the fact that often when I come to Andrews, I actually enjoy the hospitality of the home that he and Mary have made. I have to tell you also that for me this is another happy interchange with Andrews University. As I look back on my life, my first interchange with this campus came when I was 9 years old. My father was sent by the Trans-Africa Division to get his MA, and I had the joy of living in Garland F-13 for a whole year. Saw my first winter, but became acquainted with the campus in those days, and of course came back for seminary and a doctoral program, and I've been here many times, including this one. My work brings me here twice a year, and I am one of those people who has benefited from the work of this institution and those of you who have devoted your lives to its function. This afternoon, my plan is to talk about the relationship between organizational structure and the concept we have of church. The title of my presentation is From Ecclesia to Something Else. The word ecclesia being the common word in the New Testament for church. A common translation of this word is called out ones, those who are called out, understood by theologians to be an indication that the church should be understood to consist of those who have been called out of the world by the gospel to form a community, an organic living community that is the beachhead of the kingdom of God on earth. As a harbinger of the coming kingdom, the church, that Bible tells us, is highly prized by the Almighty, who has a great interest in its well-being. Because of my understanding of the church as community, because Armenian theology that envisions humans as choice-capable beings appeals to me, and because I am the offspring of some doughty Welsh English ancestors, I did not say dowdy, but doughty, and because I've given my life to the church, and I have to admit, because I am a bit curmudgeonly and don't like to be told what to do very well, the church and how it is perceived and how it operates has been and continues to be of abiding interest to me. Now, in my case, the subject that I'm going to address this afternoon has a backstory, some of which I need to tell. This is the fourth time, actually, that in a public forum I have addressed the subject of the church and its and infrastructure. The first time I did so was in the spring of 2010 at the West Coast Religion Teachers Convention that met at Burman University up in Canada. There I read a paper entitled Organizational Theory and the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In that paper, I applied standard organizational theory to the SDA Church, something that I will allude to later on in this paper. Interestingly, there was a respondent designated for that paper, but when the time came for him to respond, he politely demurred, saying that he himself was too invested in church structure to give a fair assessment. At that time, he happened to be a vice president of the General Conference. I was a little disappointed because when you read a paper, there's always a desire to have some feedback. I addressed the subject of organizational systems in the church in the spring of 2011, again at the West Coast Religion Teachers Conference. And I did so a third time on my own, on the campus of my own university, where I read a paper with a very brave title, The Future of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, of course, in light of organizational theory. And in this third paper, I postulated that we as believers might one day look back at the 2010 General Conference session as one of the notable church gatherings in our history, simply because of the events that transpired there. Using the criteria laid out by Charles B. Stosier and his co-authors in a recent book, I suggested that the conservatives who seized power in Atlanta should rightly and without malice, and I want to emphasize that, without malice, they should be designated fundamentalists, for they fit the criteria laid out by Stosier quite closely. And I would like to just mention those criteria for you. The first one they list is a radical dualism by which all aspects of life are characterized as either good or bad. The second one is a powerful inclination to interpret all authoritative texts, laws, and teachings in the most literal way possible. The third is the requirement for a radical conversion experience. The fourth is what they call paranoid thinking, and I don't know exactly what they mean by that. The last one is an apocalyptic worldview. And I would like to digress here just to make the point that the word fundamentalist is almost always used today in a pejorative sense. It's a put-down. I am not using it as a pejorative. I'm using it perhaps more in an original sense where it designates those who want to return to the fundamentals of the faith. So please, when I use this word, I do not intend any pejorative element in it. Okay? I then went on to pick up on the work of Peter Berger and Anton Seidefeld, pointing out their observation that fundamentalists typically use one of two strategies when relating to the larger world. The first one has them giving up on society as something so far gone it cannot be redeemed. And so they withdraw to the fringes of society where they work to gather the true and faithful and to establish their creed as the taken for granted reality. From those places of safety, they occasionally fire salvos back at the world, but their best and most devoted efforts are directed toward gathering and forming and reforming the true faithful, drawing up societal lines for what they believe will become a God-endorsed utopia. Now, Berger and Seidefeld point out that this first strategy results in the creation of what might be called mini-authoritarian states, tightly formed and monitored communities where fundamentalists work hard to control the circumstances of lives of the faithful, sometimes going to considerable extremes. Many examples of such communities can be found, the best known and most radical ones being those of Jim Jones and David Koresh, which we all know ended in disaster, and more recently that of Warren Jeffs, the saga of which is still unfolding in our time. In spite of the notoriety that sometimes generated by these endeavors, the effects of this first strategy on the larger society are negligible. Little to nothing of societal consequence accrues from those kind of efforts. The fundamentalists simply end up living in rural, out-of-the-way places that allow them little to no effect on society. And some of you who were active in the 1980s remember that we had quite a spate of those kind of things in our church that I think were eventually designated as independent ministries. They gave administrators a lot of headaches. A second strategy identified by Berger and Seidefeld is of much greater interest to me because it has the prospect of much greater effect. That instead of giving up and abandoning a society, the second strategy has fundamentalists working to take it over. They see a propitious moment and they seize it, managing by various means to take over with a clear intent of imposing their view of reality on the whole of the thing that they have overtaken. This strategy, rather than aiming to create some parallel mini-system, is, or it becomes totalitarian, aiming to take over everything in order to make of it a new reality. A key component of which is the desire to bring about a return to some perceived past golden era. The most notable and egregious and extreme example of this, of course, in our time would be ISIS. But there are many lesser examples that could be cited, some of which are quite mild. But in all cases, those who dissent under this strategy do not fare well at all. And in that paper that I read on my own campus, I went on to reflect on what might happen should those in church governance adopt a totalitarian strategy, noting also that totalitarian strategies are inimical to religion due to its essentially voluntary nature. It was a long paper. It was received by some people with great joy and excitement and other people with great distress. Now, all of that is the backstory that brings me to what I wish to say today. I wish to focus particularly on the intersection of organizational structure and the church as community. In particular, I want to make the salient and urgent point that a church, which we have already noted is an organic living dynamic community, may, for reasons that will be explained here, experience an unconsidered or non-deliberate change in its own ecclesiology, effectively moving it away from the concept of church as a community of believers to something else if those who are leading it do not very carefully mind their organizational language and processes. Please notice there, my particular interest here is the unconsidered and non-deliberate change in the core understanding of church. For those whose view of church is formed by the scriptural idea of ecclesia, such an eventuality would be unsavory in the extreme. Further, I wish to note again, for reasons that I will explain later, that this matter is of enormous significance to churches because of the way church organizations themselves function. The hard truth is that if matters of organization are not very carefully tended, it is quite possible to end up with something that is called church, but that behaves and operates in ways inimical to the biblical vision. I was first alerted to the possibility of an unconsidered ecclesiological change by a comment I read written down by Katie Funk Wiebe in The Christian Leader. She said the following, and I quote, "I sense that we are allowing business terms to creep into our language. I am convinced that because language shapes our thinking and actions, we change the nature of the church and its leadership if we substitute business language for body language. An organism quickly becomes an organization if it is thought about in that way." This statement struck me with considerable force because Katie Funk Wiebe indicates here that the church can change its very essence by non-deliberate and unconsidered means. My tendency has always been to think that the church changes because of theological reflection, that it changes carefully and deliberately after dialogue about theological ideas, but that is not what Wiebe said. She said that because language shapes our thinking and actions, by merely changing language, self-perception can be changed. This statement struck me further because Wiebe uses the present tense here. She says, "I sense we are allowing business terms to creep into our language." She is speaking of something that she is currently observing within the Christian church. It is going on right now. I was left to wonder, could it really be that something as apparently innocuous as a change in language could result in something as stupendous and significant as a change in core understandings? That the use of business language rather than body language could actually result in a shift in ecclesiological self-perception, effectively changing a living organism into a mere organization. This disturbance of my mental equilibrium sent me on a search, the reflective results of which I share with you this afternoon. When I discovered that the kind of change that Katie Funk Wiebe talks about is indeed possible, that the change can occur because the process that opens the way for an unconsidered ecclesiological concept change, the process that enables that to occur is actually embedded within the nature of organizational structure itself. One of the best ways to understand this, and here I rely on the contents of the first paper I mentioned at the beginning, is to look through the eyes of organizational theorists, people who are fascinated with and who study organizations, how they are born, grow, function, and finally die. One of the better known postulations of organizational theorists is that there is a prevailing and all but inevitable and inexorable organizational life cycle called, by the way, the organizational life cycle, which all organizations pass through. Depending on which school of organizational theory you read, this life cycle is said to have four or five stages, beginning with a startup or entrepreneurial stage, moving on through a growth stage that is often broken into two parts, early growth, which is often quite rapid, and middle growth, where growth slows, followed by a mature stage where growth becomes very slow or stops altogether. And I want to digress here just to tell you the characteristics they give of mature stage organizations. They list the following. Infrastructure is of enormous size to the point there is a policy for everything. There are many employees whose entire focus is on tending infrastructure rather than frontline mission. The treatment of employees is highly standardized with more interest in fairness than in merit. Operations become regulated by policies more than by opportunities. New hires are evaluated more on loyalty than on entrepreneurial spirit. Employees gain more control over mission than volunteers, and lastly, a large proportion of resources are allocated to infrastructure. Those are the indicators of what they call a mature stage organization. Now, the mature stage is followed by a decline stage, which leads to the most critical stage, known as the crisis stage. Depending on the actions of those in leadership, the crisis stage may be followed either by renewal or gradual or even rapid demise. This, according to organizational theorists, is the trajectory through which all organizations, including churches, will pass through given enough time. Now, it turns out in this life cycle, there are two critical elements that play a determinative role. The first and most obvious one is the crisis stage itself, where the way leaders approach and handle crises can lead either to organizational renewal or organizational decline. Organizations that have leaders who foresee crises and manage them well, who are willing to adjust the status quo to reflect new circumstances, who take necessary and sensible risks, may renew themselves, while those that have leaders who do not foresee or handle crisis well, or who are so enraptured by the status quo that they cannot change, go much more quickly toward demise. Points of crisis are significant in the organizational life cycle because they threaten, since they threaten organizational well-being or existence, they become the only times when any real prospect of significant change occurs. It is simply the case that the larger and more complex its infrastructure, the more fixed to the past an organization will be, especially if it has experienced significant success. Another way of saying this is that the more complex the infrastructure becomes and the more the success that can be looked up on, the more difficult it is for an organization to adjust to a new set of circumstances. By the time the late stages of organizational cycle are reached, the infrastructure in an organization will have created such a great amount of inertia that it will be almost impossible for it to change, which sets things up for a likely crisis if change does indeed come to the marketplace. This reality has elicited the observation that many companies fail not because the future was unpredictable, but because it was unpalatable. So crisis is a dangerous opportunity that, if handled well, may lead on to organizational rejuvenation, but if handled poorly, may lead to organizational decline. Now, I want to make another digression here, because it's worth noting that in the for-profit world, there are two elements that come into play at points of crisis that are absent in church organizations. Those two elements, first of all, in the for-profit world are the existence of shareholders who, if they become very unhappy, can force precipitous change at a shareholders' meeting. The second would be the prospect of some predatory entity that is wanting to take over the company, which can also force significant change. But you realize that in a denomination, there are no corresponding entities. Nobody is looking to take over the denomination. And especially in churches with big infrastructures, the members, who are the rough equivalent of shareholders, are usually so remote from organizational power that they can seldom, if ever, bring about significant change. In consequence, change in churches tends to come almost exclusively at the hands of those who are in leadership positions. And with the exception of situations where leaders give in to the temptation of adopting totalitarian methodologies, and that's my concern today, the prospect of leaders bringing about significant change in a church is very small indeed, because organizations tend to promote those who are most loyal, and churches easily sanctify their structures, making change seem unrighteous. Still further, those in power tend to be the ones who benefit most from the status quo, so are most unlikely to change the status quo. For these reasons, churches have been known to simply disappear before agreeing to change, Methodism in England being a relatively recent and prime example. Now, the second critical element that I want to talk about, and this one interests me the most, has to do with the development and function of what we call infrastructure. Though more hidden than the effect of crisis, the effect of the development and abiding presence of infrastructure, particularly as an organization ages, becomes a major factor in determining what the nature and future of that organization will be. Now, it's not hard to figure out how and why infrastructure develops. As a movement catches on in the mind of the public, it grows. Early growth is often quite rapid, with volunteers and informal conversation being the primary purveyors of mission. And by the way, we treat informal communication far too lightly. If you were to get a flyer from the local automobile dealer inviting you to come and buy a car, you would probably read it and be very dismissive. But if your friend told you, "I went to that place and got a very good deal," you would be far more inclined to go there and do your business. As a movement, at some point, by the way, a movement becomes too large for the early charismatic leaders to manage by themselves, and the need to create some kind of structure becomes obvious and urgent. And those of you who know Adventist history know that there was a real struggle in early Adventism, because at first they wanted no organization of any kind. But as the movement caught on, it became very clear that they had to have some. And so organizational structure began. The past toward organization is easy to trace. The prosecution of mission requires vision, which is broken down into strategy, which is reduced to plans that eventually get embedded in policy, which, when assembled, creates organizational structure and practice. And organizational practice pursued over time creates organizational culture and identity. By this process, organizations stabilize themselves to become predictable and efficient, and they gain the real prospect of projecting themselves from a successful past through a successful present all the way, as long as the future ends up being similar to the past, to a successful future. In the midst of all the exciting growth that makes the creation of structure necessary, something happens that goes largely unnoticed. Just as surely as the creation of infrastructure brings stability, it also initiates what theorists call organizational entropy. The technical name for the process that brings on the aging and disordering and subsequent possible death of a movement or organization. Speaking about infrastructure, theorist Jeffrey Saltzman says the purpose of these rules is to allow the organization to make decisions using standard operating procedures as a guideline, and hence remove from the organization the need to think about the decisions being made. But, and here I quote, removing the need to think about some decisions, that's what infrastructure does, carries with it an inherent risk, the risk of mediocrity, or worse, the risk of extinction. What Salzman is alluding to here is that the establishment of infrastructure has three effects. First, it sets itself up in competition for resources that would otherwise have gone to frontline mission. So the point here is that infrastructure is not mission. It's supposed to facilitate mission, and as infrastructure gets bigger, it competes for missional money. Secondly, as infrastructure grows to be more complex, it uses more resources, so there are fewer resources for the front line of mission. And here is a clue, I think, as to why so many denominations, as they age, shed their institutions. Because infrastructure has become so complex, they no longer have money to pay for frontline activities. Secondly, the emergence of infrastructure places employees in among the volunteers, who then tend to dilute their spirit of volunteerism because there are now paid people to do the work. And thirdly, and most importantly to our interest this afternoon, the appearance and growth of infrastructure produces and makes available to those who have charge of the infrastructure a new kind of power that we will call managerial or administrative power. These three things, competition for resources, the appearance of paid personnel, and the rise of administrative power, become the elements that affect the future of an organization. And while the first two items are important and quite interesting, I want to turn our attention to the third one, the appearance of administrative power. For it is the appearance of this kind of power that turns out to be a key factor in the possibility of an unconsidered shift in ecclesiological concept. And probably the best way for me to describe this is to begin with the observation that in the early stages of an organization, the leaders who originally articulate the vision have no administrative power, for there is no organization or policy system to grant it. Early leaders have only the power of persuasion, exhortation, encouragement, prayer, personal appeal, and personal example, all of which depend on winning the voluntary compliance of adherents to achieve their desired ends. If they are to succeed, they have to bring followers to the point of willing consent and compliance. This modality fits beautifully with the essential nature of religion as a voluntary thing. In other words, early leaders have to rely on the winning of personal commitment and investment in order for a religious organization to function, but that's precisely the ethos of religion at its heart. It's a voluntary occasion. But the appearance of infrastructure brings with it a different dynamic, for it introduces and very quickly brings to bear a new kind of power that is very efficient, is immediately available to leaders and leaders only, but, and this is a point that is routinely missed, it operates by means quite opposite to persuasion. Administrative power does not necessarily have to concern itself with the voluntary nature of the commitments of those who come under its jurisdiction, for it operates by the power of demand or requirement. Administrative power is the power of mandate, the ability to use the prospect of penalty as motivation toward compliance. This difference between persuasion power and coercive power is very important to explore. When a charismatic leader encounters a problem, it is time for visitation, persuasion, exhortation, appeal, invitation, prayer, and even tears. He or she has to renew the vision and call the adherents back to renewed commitment to the vision, to a remaking of the foundational commitments that the movement or organization formed around in the first place. Early leaders have to rely on the power of persuasion or exhortation, even though it is not very efficient and may require time and muddling along to achieve its purposes. Its primary strength is that it elicits the willing compliance of adherents, and if you study volunteers, they oftentimes will give you a higher degree of commitment than an employee because of the volitional nature of their commitment. The emergence of managerial power makes for a very different scenario. Rather than having to expend time and effort trying to persuade, a person with managerial power may go directly to policy, by way of which compliance can then be required. With policy and infrastructure in place, decision making can be rather straightforward, willing compliance considered or not. The temptation for leaders to use administrative power has shown itself to be considerable. One reason is that it tends to readily stave off any challenge to authority. Secondly, it is fair in that it applies across the board. And thirdly, it usually requires relatively little deliberation, so a solution can be quickly found to the problem and the organization can get on to other things. And when a religious organization is careful to limit the use of managerial power to issues of infrastructure and management, life can be very good. But when it allows for a generous expansion of the use of managerial power to include also matters that pertain to belief and faith, it likely enters a whole new arena. History shows that the temptation to broaden managerial power expansively is a temptation that is very difficult to resist. In far too many cases, leaders have succumbed quite readily to the temptation of using managerial power to deal with ideological and belief issues. Discrepancies over doctrine and belief and commitment can be very challenging and messy and prolonged in resolution. So administratively powerful leaders face the great temptation of looking at belief issues as management issues to be settled, not by argumentation or discussion or persuasion, but by appealing to a policy which, after which compliance and non-compliance can be easily measured. After that, the path to resolution can be very short and sometimes very ugly. When a religious movement accepts or allows this shift to take place broadly, when it allows for matters of faith and belief to be treated as matters of policy and management, when it trades persuasion for policy, invitation for requirement, at its heart it transitions away from being a living organism towards being a mere organization. It transitions from being a community to being a company. Administrative power does not work by persuasion and invitation, but by coercion. It does not work on the inside, but from the outside. It works by mandate, able to administer a penalty of some kind for non-compliance. It overlays, therefore, voluntary commitment, which is the essence of religion, with involuntary mandate, something inimical to faith. Being elected to a position of power, then, does not make a person right. It only makes them powerful and possibly dangerous to the central ethos of religion. While administrative power is important and useful, it should not, indeed cannot, effectively be used to manage religious commitments and ideas, for as we all know, coercive power applied to belief and commitment leads not toward genuine faith, but to artificiality, duplicity, and even outright hypocrisy. What I'm trying to point out here is that any essentially voluntary organization that makes a shift from invitation to mandate in essential matters brings about a subtle but substantial change in its own nature. Put in theological terms, it unthinkingly changes its ecclesiology. It moves in an unconsidered way from the idea of church as a community of believers where coercive power is viewed as inimical to life and is so pushed to the fringes of the community, to a hierarchical concept of church that is as a sanctified organization where centralized power is viewed as essential. In a community of believers, a problem is an occasion for fellowship and exhortation and discussion and invitation for even messy interactions. In an organization, it is time to make a policy or find a way, a policy-driven way, by way of which compliance or non-compliance can be measured and action taken. And once that kind of shift takes place in a religious movement, it is not very long before orthodoxy and heresy get defined by policy. and life becomes very difficult for those who dissent. In so many cases, this is the very dynamic that has brought death to those who dissented at the hands of those who persuaded themselves that by destroying the dissenters, they were only doing the work of God. Now, while researching this topic some time ago, I happened upon mention of a fascinating study, Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity, written by Walter Bauer way back in 1934. Now, I have to tell you that Walter Bauer's work, some of it has been discredited, but when I used this in a paper in the West Coast Religion Teachers Group, a church historian warned me about Walter Bauer, but he told me I have used him correctly here, so I'm brave enough to share with you. According to Alistair McGrath, who cites the study, the conclusion Bauer came to is that, at least in the early Christian church, basic unity did not seem to be located at the level of doctrines, but at the level of relationship with the same Lord. Christian unity lay in the worship of the same Lord rather than in the formal statement of doctrine, which is how Orthodox tends to be defined. Bauer goes on to claim that a variety of views which were tolerated in the early church gradually began to be regarded with suspicion by the later church. An Orthodox consensus began to emerge in which opinions that had once been tolerated were discarded as inadequate. The operative question immediately becomes one of how this Orthodox consensus developed. And Bauer's answer is quite striking, that Orthodoxy was the result of the growing power of Rome, which increasingly came to impose its own views upon others, using the term heresy to refer to views it rejected. In other words, as the Bishop of Rome's infrastructure-driven power increased, he was able to transition from invitation to mandate. He was able to take more and more initiative to himself and his office, and he was able to apply greater and more substantial penalties to those who dissented. This is what brought Bauer to his conclusion that the difference between orthodoxy and heresy often seems arbitrary. It appears to be more a derivation of the opinions of those in power than anything else. It was by this process that the Church of Rome grew to such prominence. That's his opinion. All of this, of course, is cause for very sobering thought. When a religious organization, for example, trademarks its name, has it taken time to think about what it has done to itself? When it hires in-house lawyers to be in attendance at all significant meetings in order to advise on the legal implications of its decision-making? When it employs a large number of people whose sole task it is to travel the world to make sure policy is not violated, what has it done? When its language becomes more that of a for-profit corporation than a community of those bound together by a great hope, to what point has it arrived? When it works toward creating an orthodoxy to which all must assent or be punished, are we still able to call it a community of called out ones? Or a last question, which may be the most troubling of all. When a church becomes a corporation, is it safe to believe that the Holy Spirit is still at work in it, or should we become very alert to the possibility that it has become something too human to be divine? There are, of course, more pressing questions, but I leave them alone for now. And I suspect, of course, that you would like me to now answer the gnarly questions I bring up. But the truth of the matter is they need a lot of reflection and collective discussion. But clearly, I hope I've been able to establish in your minds that the rise and role of infrastructure, how it functions and what power it grants to a few, is something that needs very careful thought in believing communities. While necessary, infrastructure in a church organization cannot be left to function like infrastructure in a for-profit company. And looking at our own system, I think it is clear that if we do not find some way to put a bridle on infrastructure in our own church, in time we will either more closely resemble a for-profit company or the hierarchical system such as we see in the Church of Rome. Gone will be any semblance of the energetic, exciting, dynamic, voluntary community that first grew up around the Blessed Hope. Somehow we need to give our best and collective attentions to these things, lest we thoughtlessly transition away from being a mission-driven community of believers to something else that probably ought not to be even named among the faithful. Thank you kindly. Okay, questions. My friend Gary will answer all questions now.
I didn't have anything to do with preparing this presentation, let me assure you. I'm just here to facilitate the questions.
Well, I'm part of the choir that I think you're preaching to.
Oh, okay.
But trying to put myself on the other side of this consent argument, what's the alternative? You've kind of described the life cycle of an organization, of a church, and in the case of life cycles, the only alternative to getting old is something worse.
No, no.
Let me just kind of add something to this. When I look at the religious universe and look at attempts to a church renewal, I see some examples that are not too encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
In the Roman Catholic Church, they have had renewal movements. We call them the religious orders, Franciscans, Jesuits, and so forth, which seem to affect a benefit, but they themselves go through cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Another example would be the mainline churches, where they have gotten quite laid back when it comes to doctrinal matters and things like that, but it hasn't resulted in noticeable health.
Well, you know, my own answer to that is to look at the fact that the most vital and powerful religious movements are the ones that belong to the people, not to some structure. You know, I think the most successful religious movement perhaps in all history is the Pentecostal movement. Now, I do not advocate for Pentecostalism, but it fascinates me that that movement has exploded around the world in unprecedented ways with virtually no infrastructure, because it belongs to the people. I think the same is true of early Adventism, see? I also am quite interested in Mormonism, which does not have very much infrastructure, at least not apparently, that the mission of local congregations belongs to the leaders of that, and of course they have some structure. I look also, for example, at an organization in the town where I live called Gospel Outreach. This is a group of people who are working hard to provide funding for indigenous workers in the 1040 window. And it's a fascinating organization because it operates on 1.6% of its income, that it pays no salaries of any kind except for indigenous people who are spreading the gospel. Everybody who works there is a volunteer. And some of those people are working 60 hours a week and enjoying it immensely. See? So, I do not want to suggest that there is no need for infrastructure, but it does seem to me that this infrastructure should be kept as small as possible so that the number of volunteers remains high in relationship to the number of paid employees, and the sense of ownership of mission is retained by the people in the pews much more than it is retained by people who are administering it from some office somewhere.
Not having any salaried workers doesn't keep a group from being very hierarchical. You mentioned the Mormons.
Yeah.
I canvassed amongst the Mormons for a while.
Yeah.
They have a very rigid hierarchy.
Yes.
A very powerful one.
Yeah. No, I think, and you know, I mean, I guess my final defense comes from a colleague of mine who makes the observation that if you look at church history, the saints have never had their act together for more than a few minutes at a time, you know, you know, but I'm not sure I can answer your question with a great deal of precision. What I do know is that the extreme of a big infrastructure is inimical, I think, to the heart of religion and to religious commitments owned by the people, that there's no greater witness for the gospel than a person who has experienced it.
Let me take a stab at helping you out. Recall a seminary professor that both you and I had classes from way back. He was fascinated by the notion, he was an American, but he was fascinated by the notion of the concept in the British Parliament of the loyal opposition. And you talked about how administrative power comes down hard on opposition, but the British system at least seems to not only accept, but foster the notion that there are some people who are opposed to the current power structure, but are still loyal British citizens. And he, as an American, found that fascinating, and I think wanted to apply it to theological matters, that there could be a loyal opposition, and you have to deal with that sort of paradox.
A loyal opposition that should be heard and
protected.
And listened to carefully, because, you know, one of the valuable lessons I learned, and I actually learned this from Gary, he doesn't know this, but you'll find out now, is that, you know, the best kind of committees that you can have are those where you have some people who are on the fringes of your movement, who will provide you a view of reality that's different from the one that the people invested in the status quo have. And that many times the best observations you have come from this loyal opposition. They offer a corrective view that is very valuable if it is listened to. So,
as a field director in gospel outreach,
ah,
thank you very much.
All right.
And you're right.
Yeah.
People work incredible hours and love it.
Yeah.
Your presentation reminds me quite a bit of a paper produced by a colleague of mine, college, Charles Teal, The Movement from Sect Church.
Mm. No, I have not run into that.
I think it was written back in the 1970s, perhaps. It was responded to very negatively and very forcefully by then President Robert Pearson, who said, "This must not happen." But it seemed to think that he could mandate that it would stop.
Yeah.
The only organizations that seem to have avoided this, although those that we refer to as arrested sects, that would be the Friends, Quakers, and perhaps to a degree, Mennonites. They have avoided infrastructure, they have avoided growth, simply because they don't want to face what comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
But the movement from sect to church tends to parallel what you were saying about the growth of organizations, and I was very intrigued with the parallels between them. You can check out Charles Teal's paper.
Okay, yeah. And I actually happen to favor infrastructure up to a point. You know, I think that Adventist missions has benefited enormously from a lean, organized structure. I do worry that structure is becoming so complicated now. I mean, I remember when I first was employed in January 1 of 1977, that the policy book was one red book about an inch and an eighth in size. I think today there are three books that are like 2 inches, see? And so, you know, the
division has its own version.
Well, it could be, see, but you understand that that all of that is weight that has to be borne by someone. I mean, I see the same thing in academic institutions. I am having more and more to deal with assessment and evaluation and stuff like that. And, you know, it really burdens the administrative function. I did not come into academic realm to chase numbers all over the place. I came to teach students. And you know, the more of that stuff we do, yeah, the more of that stuff we have to do. I mean, for example, we had a AAA visit, and I'm not here to speak pro or con against AAA, but it cost our university a lot of money to prepare that report, but nobody contributed to our bottom line in order to do that. See, we get this from the federal government all the time, and you know, if I ran the world, I would say, if you create a mandate for somebody, you must pay for it. Okay, before you send it out, you send the money to cover it. See, because administrative power and structure, you can create policies ad nauseam, but somebody has to live with those, see? And that's true inside church as well as outside.
Is it possible that the current Pope Francis is attempting to some degree, reverse this process?
I think so. I think so. And you know, the Curia in Rome are not very happy with the, with Pope Francis, you know, because in some ways he's undermining, you know, we don't stop to think how some people become institutional creatures, that they thrive inside institutions and they don't want any life outside of it. And therefore they know all the policies, they can recite them, they live, they know all the allowances, they know all the ups and downs, and they live within that and they make sure nobody disturbs the status quo, see? And my position is that I think we should always be disturbing the status quo to make sure that infrastructure is serving mission and not being something in and of itself.
You are employed by the organization that has many lawyers and many policies, so I consider you to be a very brave man.
Well, I told you, I'm somewhat curmudgeonly and I come from a doughty stock, so I made a decision years ago that I'm not going to be afraid of speaking my mind, so sorry about that.
Okay. My question. In light of what happened at the last GC session, how they dealt with the issue of the ordination of women pastors, organizationally, how should they have handled it? What mistakes did they make?
Well, my opinion on that is very straightforward. I think that we had the only solution to that question back in 1990, and that was to allow each division to develop what needed to be developed in its area. You know, the idea that everything is the same all the way around the world is nonsense. I have friends who go to the Caribbean, who live there, and they tell you that the leaders sometimes come back and say, "Well, the brethren said this," but we all know that in our country we don't do that. See. And you know, but on this particular issue, it has become a very strange development in my mind, because it's in some ways it's a theological issue that's being decided by popular vote, and you know I have to tell you that everything I know about it is secondhand, because I love the response I'm able to give. That while all of you in San Antonio, I was in the Middle East walking in the footsteps of Jesus with some students. So, you know, sorry about that. But so, you know, I think that theologically we have messed up on the subject, because there is a very clear path for women into ministry. If you recognize that both the giftedness and the capacity, both the inclination and the capacity to do ministry are gifts of the Spirit. The Bible is very clear about that. And there is no gender distinction in those statements about the gift of the Spirit. And so the human part of this is to ask the question, do we see in you the giftedness of the Spirit? It's not, are you a man or a woman? The question is, do we see the giftedness? And if we see the giftedness, it's not our prerogative to say the Holy Spirit cannot use this person, especially not when we all talk about, you know, in Scandinavian times when children got up and preached, and you know, you have God using insects in His cause, and a donkey speaks, and you know, even there's a prediction that the rocks will cry out if necessary, but women cannot. You know, it becomes ludicrous. It becomes ludicrous. See, and then you look in Adventist history that the pathway to the acceptance of Ellen White's giftedness as a spokesperson for God comes precisely through the discussion of the discussion of the gift of the Spirit. I don't think the appearance of any prophet in a religious community is ever good news. We would not like it if a prophet appeared here. See, we don't like prophets. We stone them now, and then we whitewash their tombs. See, but the acceptance of her giftedness in the Adventist community, you read the old reviews, it's because they began to articulate the doctrine of the gifts of the Spirit, and they saw there that prophecy is one of them, that it's open-ended, and there's no distinction given that it can only be for males. And it seems to me that it would have been a very simple thing for us to follow that rationale. to then allow each area of the world to do what they need to do. And, I mean, I have to smile because you tell the Chinese that women cannot successfully minister when the largest Adventist congregation in the world is in China. See?
Run by a woman.
Yeah, and run by a woman. And, you know, the communists are ahead of us. Okay? Simple as that. So that's my answer.
Thank you for your presentation. I was thinking about the history of the Catholic Church that you mentioned and how they moved to that infrastructure that put policy ahead of invitation. Based on our world, where we're deeply connected, back then it took decades, whereas today someone can start a movement on social media in a matter of weeks and get it running. Do you see that as speeding up the life cycle? Or can it halt the life cycle? Or how does that affect your organization or our church?
Wow, Andrew, I have never thought of that. Because my guess is that it might speed up the life cycle somewhat, because all the social media does is it's really a means of communication that might be, get people connected more quickly. But I don't think it's going to radically affect a movement might grow more quickly, but I don't think it's going to age necessarily more quickly. But I would have to put that under my pillow for a few weeks and think about it. But it's a very interesting question. And I should turn it around to you because you know a lot more about social media than I do. So maybe you should turn that into a project and write a report while you're still here. How about that? It's a good question.
Joe.
My first remark might be interpreted as comedy. You should have made an altar call.
I should have?
Surprised who would come down and throw themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And maybe I should have called instead for a little contribution for this organization, a big one, right?
Yes.
Yes.
I was in the seminary with your dad.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
I think that the issue of stasis in a church and the call back to the beginnings and let's do things the way we know we're right is that we give a virtue to stasis and to the structure of everything. That this isn't something that just takes place in organization, it takes place in physics as well.
Mm.
The space-time continuum is a stationary, changeless structure. Everything that has occurred or ever will occur, blah, blah, blah. And time is basically reduced to space, which is stasis.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the ability to change things like we might think that time does. It may be cyclical and everything goes back to the beginning. It may be linear. May take on some other features. But I think that that maybe from the Enlightenment, we get this idea that there are meta laws out there that guarantee the kind of laws that we live by, and that govern the way organizations take shape, and that they're changeless. We can reason everything out. We don't need to do any kind of other research other than what goes on in the head by using these meta laws or the laws that we've developed out there. So it may be just an idea that we need to look at this idea of stasis and structure in a way that questions its legitimacy and its value in terms of change and flexibility and novelty and creativity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I guess I don't know enough about physics to...
Well, neither do I, but I have read that.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm while you were saying that, it just struck me that there is one example in Adventist history that illustrates my point very nicely, and I don't remember the exact details. Maybe there's a church historian here who will help me. But there was at some point where a group of workers left, I think they left Michigan and went out to Waukon, Iowa. Okay.
59.
Yeah, and who was that did that?
There was a group of them. There was about a dozen, 15 farmers.
Yeah, and they pretty much gave up on life here, and they went out there, and what I remember was that, I think it was the whites, made a perilous journey in the middle of winter, even crossed the Mississippi River in peril, and what did they do? They didn't go out there to read policy, right? They didn't say, well, you quit the program. They went out there to appeal to them, and beg them and cry with them and remonstrate with them and exhort them, and lo and behold, the bulk of them came back. See? And that to me is a beautiful picture of church as organic entity functioning, okay? And, you know, I think we need to realize that, doctrine, doing doctrine is messy business, right? To me, it's kind of like sailing upwind, if you know what I mean. When you're sailing upwind, you cannot go from point south to point north directly into the wind. You have to sail back and forth like this, and when you get over here, you realize that I'm too far to the right. I'm going to run on the rock, so I turn and I sail back this way, and I cross the center line, and I may get too far over there. You know, doing theology, and all you have to do is look at the whole development of Christology in early Christian history, 400 years of going back and forth, of getting it wrong and fixing it, and getting it wrong again and fixing it, and finally we end up with something that becomes universally accepted. And the idea that I can do theology in 40 years as a professional and do it all successfully myself, I think is something we need to allow latitude for making a mess, as long as we are responsible to try and clean it up and go over and make a mess over on this side, you know, because that's the story of human history, see. And the idea of just declaring this is the way it is, and if you get over here, you're done. I mean, obviously, if you run on the rocks, that's another thing, but, so, I think Madeline.
Well, I wasn't going to send you off on a sidetrack, but after hearing David's question and your response, I just have to comment that the last thing I did before leaving home to come to this meeting was to read on Facebook a brand new post, I think. The Italian Union has just voted that the vote in San Antonio was absolutely unacceptable to them, a very forceful statement, more so than the Scandinavian unions.
So the emotions of the Italian came in there. I like it.
And despite their famous forebear who was here, it felt differently. They have declared very forcefully that it's unacceptable and that their women have to be equal in ministry to their men. They reviewed the history of the many votes and of the many study commissions that all said it was acceptable in the Bible, and they said, therefore, we consider this vote unacceptable, and we will decide very shortly just how we will implement that equality.
Yeah, and you see, this is a perfect illustration of the fact that administrative authority cannot control thought. It might control behavior, but it does not control the opinions of people or the condition of their heart. It doesn't happen. And that's why I think administrative power is very valuable as long as it deals with mission. But when it starts getting out into trying to control all the affairs of human life, it fails. See? So, I mean, I think that's a perfect example.
I just want to say I appreciate your comments about mission. By the way, I got to know this guy. He was my dean, you know, at the theology. I graduated Walla Walla, and he said, Chad, go back to Alaska, you know, and go preach to your people. Well, I took that very seriously. And while I was in Tokiak, Alaska, a village of 800 people, and by the way, if you were to go up to Anchorage, which is where you would land if you flew from Seattle, it would take you about $900 a round trip just to fly to Tokiak and back, just to Anchorage. It gives you some perspective of how isolated mission is out there.
Yeah.
My point is this. When I was out in Pontiac, nobody was concerned about women's ordination. Nobody was even concerned about an ecumenical movement. People were just craving Christ.
Yeah.
And when I asked Christ for help, he sent somebody up that was in the Assembly of God, and I didn't know what to do because that was all the help I had. And I asked him, what would you teach if you did help? He said, the Bible. And I said, that's good enough for me. And my point is this. When we get that far out into the front of the mission line, everything in the back that we gripe and grumble and fight about here at the core of Adventism, if you want to call it the core, is irrelevant.
Mm.
In the eyes of those who are just
Yeah.
So I just want to say I appreciate this because everything that happened in the 2.5 years before Elizabeth and I came here to Andrews, it was just like, I got to get back out there.
Yeah. And it's so pretty exciting when people come to faith. Yeah. 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 Thank you, Chad.
Publish this in any place where it's actually going to be read widely?
I have wrestled with where to publish it, because I don't want to, my fear in talking about this is it will be understood to be trying to stick a finger in somebody's eye, and I have no interest in doing that. I do have interest in trying to engender some substantial conversation about something that I think has reached critical stage in our movement. Now, where do I publish it? You know, because if I'm pretty sure Spectrum would publish it, but that immediately tarnishes it in the eyes of the people who should hear it. I'm pretty sure that the Review will not publish it, okay? Adventist Today is another option, which may be somewhat in the middle ground, but, you know, so it's not that I'm unwilling to publish it, I just don't know where to publish it, where it would get a hearing. So I have published none of these papers, none of them. Well, I will actually, this one, I just finished this paper very recently, but I know the editor, he and I have some good history, and he actually recently asked me for an article, so maybe I'll send him this one.
I just got a comment, since we're studying Jeremiah this quarter, what you're saying is not totally new thought, because you cited lots of other scholars who are showing how organizations and churches grow and prosper and then die. And so as a prophet, a prophet would be warning about this, you know, and prophets are not very liked people, you know, Jeremiah was not well received, but I don't know, I just think this is very important that we look at this before it's too late.
Yeah, you know.
Go for it.
Okay. Here are my Lord, send Dave.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're independently wealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another thing too, that's that bludgeon, you know, they have control, and if you align, then you can lose your source of income.
Yeah, but I tell you, and I don't want to make too big a deal of this, but I remember when I was still an intern, a ministerial intern living in Massachusetts, an issue came up where I was put in a position where I would either be quiet and sacrifice my sense of integrity, or I would say something. And I remember sitting in my front room and making a deliberate decision that I will never sacrifice my sense of integrity to somebody else's mandate, even if it cost me my job. And I'm very glad that it has never yet cost me my job. And I am happy to tell you that I live in a little corner of the universe called Walla Walla, where If you actually come there, we're very happy to see you, because we're not on the way to anywhere. You know? That we are, those of you who know, we are between the little town of Dixie and the little town of Loudon, and one of those is barely on both sides of the road. It's one of them is almost on half the side. So, when my cousin came to visit me for the first time, I insisted on buying gas, filling up a gas tank. I said, because I know you only came to visit us because we're not on the way to anywhere. So. You know, I live a peaceful existence. When I lived back in the East, I was far more vociferous. I would go to constituency meetings and make fiery speeches, some of which were quite persuasive and changed the direction that people were trying to go. I am spared that where I am, so I make these little forays into academic institutions and make these speeches and then go back home.
Okay, well, let's thank Dr. Thomas for being